his great, vulturous self to his fullest height. We are troubling ourselves with this.
Antane did not let him finish.
Uncle, I know that what I am asking for is a bit out of the ordinary, and perhaps you are right. This may be a fool's errand. But really, I am not asking for very much at all. Only your blessing. I need no tools, no equipment, no supplies. My wife knows of my intentions, and I have her support. On the day of sacrifice, the robes will arrive at our house, and she will relinquish our precious child willingly. The whole protectorate will sorrow as you walk by, a great sea of sorrow, and you will go to those awful trees, those witches' handmaidens, and you will lay that little babe on the moss, and you will think that you will never lay eyes on that face again.
Antane felt his voice crack. He shut his eyes tight and tried to recompose himself. And perhaps that will be true. Perhaps I will succumb to the perils of the forest, and it will be the witch who comes to claim my child. The room was quiet and cold. The elders dared not speak. Antane seemed to grow taller than all of them. His face was lit from the inside, like a lantern.
Or, Antane continued, perhaps not. Perhaps it will be me, waiting in those trees. Perhaps I shall be the one to lift the babe from the circle of sycamores. Perhaps I shall be the one to bring that baby safely home.
Guino found his reedy voice.
But how, boy?
It is a simple plan, good father. I shall follow the map. I shall find the witch.
Antane's eyes were two black coals.
And then I shall kill her.
Chapter 25, in which Luna learns a new word. Luna woke in the dark with a searing headache. It originated from a point right behind her forehead, no larger than a grain of sand. But she felt whole universes burst behind her vision, making it alternately light, then dark, then light, then dark. She fell out of her bed and clattered onto the floor. Her grandmother snored in the swing bed on the other side of the room, taking in each breath as though it was filtered through a handful of muck. Luna pressed her hands to her forehead, trying to keep her skull from flying apart. She felt hot, then cold, then hot again. And was it her imagination, or were her hands glowing? Her feet as well.
"What's happening?" she gasped.
"Oh," her crow should have said from his perch at the window.
"Luna!"
he cawed instead.
"I'm fine," she whispered.
But she knew she wasn't. She could feel each of her bones as though they were made of light. Her eyes were hot. Her skin was slick and damp. She scrambled to her feet and stumbled out the door, taking in great gulps of night air as she did so. The waxing moon had just set, and the sky glittered with stars. Without thinking about it, Luna raised her hands to the sky, letting starlight gather on her fingers. One by one, she brought her fingers to her mouth, letting the starlight slide down her throat. Had she done this before? She couldn't remember. In any case, it eased her headache and calmed her mind.
"Caw,"
said the crow.
"Come,"
said Luna, and she made her way down the trail. Luna did not intend to make her way toward the standing stone and the tall grasses. And yet, there she was, staring at those words lit now by the stars. "Don't forget," the stone said.
"Don't forget what?"
she said out loud. She took a step forward and laid her hand on the stone. Despite the hour and despite the damp, the stone was oddly warm. It vibrated and thrummed under her hand. She glared at the words.
"Don't forget what?"
she said again. The stone swung open like a door. No, she realized, not like a door. It was a door. A door hanging in the air. A door that opened into a candlelit stone corridor with stairs leading down into the gloom.
"How?"
Luna breathed, but she couldn't continue.
"Caw,"
the crow said, though it sounded more like, I don't think you should go down there.
Quiet, you, Luna said, and she walked into the stone doorway and down the stairs.
The stairs led to a workshop, with clean, open workstations and sheaves of paper. Open books, a journal with a quill resting across the pages, with a bright black drop of ink clinging to the sharp tip as though someone had stopped in the middle of a sentence before thinking better of it and rushing away.
Hello? Luna called. Is anyone here?
No one answered. No one but the crow.
Craw, said the crow, though it sounded more like, for crying out loud, Luna, let's get out of here.
Luna squinted at the books and papers. They looked as though they were the scribbles of a crazy person, a tangle of loops and smudges and words that meant nothing. Why would someone go to all the trouble of making a book full of gibberish? She wondered.
Luna walked across the circumference of the room, running her hands along the wide table and the smooth counters. There was no dust anywhere, but no fingerprints either. The air wasn't stale, but she could detect no scent of any kind of life.
Hello, she called again. Her voice didn't echo, nor did it carry. It seemed to simply fall out of her mouth and hit the ground with a soft thump.
There was a window, which was strange, because surely she was underground, wasn't she? She had gone downstairs. But even stranger, the view outside was of the middle of the day. And what's more, it was a landscape that Luna didn't recognize. Where the mountain's crater should have been was instead a peak. A mountain peak with smoke pouring from the top, like a kettle set too long to boil.
Caw, the crow said again.
There's something wrong with this place, Luna whispered.
The hairs on her arms stood at attention, and the small of her back began to sweat. A piece of paper flew from one of the sheaves and landed on her hand. She could read it.
Don't forget, it said.
How could I forget when I didn't know to begin with? She demanded.
But who was she asking?
Oh, said the bird.
No one tells me anything, Luna shouted.
But that wasn't true. She knew it wasn't. Sometimes her grandmother told her things, or Glurk told her things, but their words flew from her mind as soon as they were said. Even now, Luna could remember seeing words like tiny bits of torn-up paper lifting from her heart and hovering just before her eyes, and then scattering away as though caught on a wind.
Come back, her heart called desperately.
She shook her head.
I'm being silly, she said out loud. That never happened.
Her head hurt. That hidden grain of sand, tiny and infinite all at once, both compact and expanding, she thought her skull might shatter.
Another sheet of paper flew from the sheaf and landed on her hands. There was no first word in the sentence, or not as it appeared to her. Instead, it looked like a smudge. After that, the sentence was clear. Is the most fundamental, and yet least understood, element of the known universe.
She stared at it.
What is the most fundamental? She asked.
She held the paper close to her face.
Show yourself!
And all at once, the grain of sand behind her forehead began to soften and release, just a bit. She stared at the word and watched as letters uncurled from the tangle of haze, mouthing each one as they appeared.
M, she mouthed.
Egg-ick. She shook her head.
What on earth is that?
A sound thundered in her ears. Bursts of light flashed behind her eyes. M-A-G-I-C. This word meant something. She was sure it meant something. And what's more, she was sure she had heard the word before, though for the life of her she couldn't remember where. Indeed, she could hardly figure out how to pronounce it.
Mm,
she began, her tongue turning to granite in her mouth.
Huh?
The crow encouraged.
Mmm,
she said again.
Caw, caw, caw,
the crow squawked joyfully.
Luna, Luna, Luna!
Mmm, magic! Luna coughed out.
Chapter 26, in which a madwoman learns a skill and puts it to use. When the madwoman was a little girl, she drew pictures. Her mother told her stories about the witch in the woods, stories that she was never sure were true. According to her mother, the witch ate sorrow, or souls, or volcanoes, or babies, or brave little wizards. According to her mother, the witch had big black boots that could travel 7 leagues in a single step. According to her mother, the witch rode on the back of a dragon and lived in a tower so tall it pierced the sky. But the madwoman's mother was dead now, and the witch was not. And in the quiet of the tower, far above the grimy fog of the town, the madwoman sensed things that she never could have sensed before her years there. And when she sensed things, she drew them, over and over and over again. Every day the sisters came into her cell unannounced and clucked their tongues at the masses of paper in the room, folded into birds, folded into towers, folded into likenesses of Sister Ignatia, and then stomped upon with the madwoman's bare feet. Covered over with scribbles and pictures and maps, every day the sisters hauled paper by the armload out of the cell to be shredded and soaked and repulped into new sheets in the binderies in the basement. But where had it come from in the first place, the sisters asked themselves. It's so easy, the madwoman wanted to tell them. Just go mad. Madness and magic are linked, after all, or I think they are. Every day the world shuffles and bends. Every day I find something shiny in the rubble. Shiny paper. Shiny truth. Shiny magic. Shiny, shiny, shiny. She was, she knew sadly, quite mad. She might never be healed. One day, as she sat on the floor in the middle of her cell, cross-legged, she had chanced upon a handful of feathers left behind by a swallow who had decided to make her nest on the narrow windowsill of the cell before a falcon had decided to make the swallow a snack. The feathers drifted in through the madwoman's window and onto the floor. The madwoman watched them land. The feathers landed on the floor right in front of her. She stared at them, the quill, the shaft, each filament of down. Then she could see the smaller structures, dust and barb and cell. Smaller and smaller went the details of her vision until she could see each particle spinning around itself like a tiny galaxy. She was as mad as they come, after all. She shifted the particles across the yawning emptiness between them, this way and that, until a new hole emerged. The feathers were no longer feathers. They were paper. Dust became paper. Rain became paper. Sometimes her supper became paper, too. And every time she made a map. "She is here," she wrote, over and over and over again. No one read her maps. No one read her words. No one bothers with the words of the mad, after all. They pulped her paper and sold it at the marketplace for a considerable sum. Once she mastered the art of paper, she found it was ever so easy to transform other things as well. Her bed became a boat for a short time. The bars on her windows became ribbons. Her one chair became a measure of silk, which she wrapped around herself like a shawl just to enjoy the feel of it. And eventually she found that she could transform herself as well, though only into very small things, and only for a little while. Her transformations were so exhausting that they sent her to bed for days. A cricket, a spider, an ant. She had to be careful not to be trodden on, or swatted. A water bug, a cockroach, a bee. She also had to make sure she was back in her cell when the bonds of her atoms felt as though they were ready to burst and fly apart. Over time, she could hold herself in a particular form for slowly increasing durations. She hoped that one day she might be able to hold her form as a bird long enough to find her way to the center of the forest. Someday. Not yet. Instead, she became a beetle. Hard, shiny,
She scuttled right under the feet of the crossbow-wielding sisters and down the stairs. She climbed onto the toes of the timid boy doing the sisters' daily chores, poor thing, afraid of his own shadow.
"Boy!" she heard the head sister shout from down the hall. "How long must we wait for our tea?"
The boy whimpered, stacked dishes and baked goods onto a tray with a tremendous clatter, and hurried down the hall. It was all the madwoman could do to hang on to the laces of his boot.
"At last," said the head sister.
The boy set the tray on the table with a tremendous crash.
"Out," the head sister boomed, "before you destroy something else."
The madwoman scuttled under the table, grateful for the shadows. Her heart went out to the poor boy as he stumbled out the door, clutching his hands together as though they were burned. The sister inhaled deeply through her nose. She narrowed her gaze. The madwoman tried to make herself as small as possible.
"Do you smell something?"
the sister asked the man in the chair opposite. The madwoman knew that man. He was not wearing his robes. Instead, he wore a fine shirt of lovely cloth and a long coat of the lightest of wool. His clothes smelled of money. He was more wrinkled than he had been the last time she had seen him. His face was tired and old. The madwoman wondered if she looked similar. It had been so long, so very, very long, since she had last seen her own face.
"I smell nothing, madam," the grand elder said, "except tea and cakes, and your own excellent perfume, of course."
"There is no need to flatter me, young man," she said, even though the grand elder was much older than she. Or he looked much older. Seeing her next to the grand elder, the madwoman realized with a start that after all these years, Sister Ignatia had never seemed to age. The old man cleared his throat.
"And this brings us to the reason I am here, my dear lady. I did what you asked, and I learned what I could learn, and the other elders did the same. And I did my best to dissuade him, but it was no use. Antane still intends to hunt the witch."
"Did he follow your advice, at least? Did he keep his plans a secret?"
There was a sound inside the voice of the head sister, the madwoman realized. Grief. She'd know that sound anywhere.
"Alas, no. People know. I don't know who told them, he or his ludicrous wife. He believes the quest to be possible, and it seems that she does, too. And others now believe the same. They all hope."
He said the word as though it was the bitterest of pills. The grand elder shuddered. The sister sighed. She stood and paced the room.
"You really don't smell that."
The grand elder shrugged, and the sister shook her head. "It doesn't matter. In all likelihood, the forest will kill him. He has never endeavored such a journey. He has no skills. He has no idea what he is doing. And his loss will prevent other, more unpleasant questions from being raised. However, it is possible that he may return. That is what troubles me." The madwoman leaned as far out of the shadows as she dared. She watched the sister's movements become more abrupt and chaotic. She watched as a slick of tears glistened right at the bottoms of her eyes.
"It is too risky."
She took in a breath to steady herself. "And it doesn't close the door on the question. If he should return finding nothing, it does not mean that there isn't something to be found by another citizen so foolhardy as to take to the woods. And if that person finds nothing, then perhaps someone else will try as well, and soon those reports of nothing become something. And soon the Protectorate starts getting ideas." Sister Ignatia was pale, the madwoman noticed. Pale and gaunt, as though she was slowly starving to death. The grand elder was silent for a long moment. He cleared his throat.
"I assume, dear lady..."
His voice trailed off. He was silent again. Then,
"I assume that one of your sisters could... well, if they could..."
He swallowed. His voice was weak. This isn't easy for either of us. I can see that you have some feeling for the boy. Indeed, your sorrow... Her voice broke, and the sister's tongue quickly darted out and disappeared back into her mouth. She closed her eyes as her cheeks flushed, as though she had just tasted the most delicious flavor in the world. Your sorrow is very real. But it can't be helped. The boy cannot return, and it must be evident to all that it was the witch who killed him. The grand elder leaned heavily upon the embroidered sofa in the sister's study. His face was pale and gaunt. He lifted his eyes to the ceiling. Even from her tiny vantage point, the madwoman could see that his eyes were wet.
"Which one?"
he asked hoarsely.
"Which one will do it?"
"Does it matter?" the sister asked.
"It does to me."
Sister Ignatia stood and swept over to the window, looking out. She waited for a long moment. Finally, she said, "All the sisters, you understand, are well-trained and thorough. It is not usual for any of them to be overly upended by the protestations of feeling. Still, they all cared for Antane more than the other tower boys. If it was anyone else, I'd send any sister and be done with it. In this case..." She sighed, turned and faced the grand elder. "I shall do it." Gerland flicked his eyes to dislodge the tears and pinned his gaze on the sister.
"Are you sure?"
"I am. And you may rest assured I will be quick. His death will be painless. He will not know of my coming. And he will not know what hit him." Chapter 27, in which Luna learns more than she wished. The stone walls were impossibly old and impossibly damp. Luna shivered. She stretched her fingers out, then curled them into fists, in and out and in and out, trying to get the blood flowing. Her fingertips felt like ice. She thought she'd never be warm. The papers swirled around her feet. Whole notebooks skittered up the crumbling walls. Inky words unhooked themselves from the page and crawled around the floor like bugs before making their way back again, chattering all the while. Each book and each paper, as it turned out, had quite a bit to say. They murmured and rambled. They talked over one another. They stepped on each other's voices. "Hush!" Luna shouted, pressing her hands over her ears. "Apologies," the papers murmured. They scattered and gathered. They swirled into great whirlwinds. They undulated across the room in waves. "One at a time," Luna ordered. "Caw," agreed the crow. "And no foolishness," it meant. The papers complied. Magic, the papers asserted, was worthy of study. It was worthy of knowledge. And so it was, Luna learned, that a tribe of magicians and witches and poets and scholars, all dedicated to the preservation, continuation, and understanding of magic, established a haven for learning and study in an ancient castle surrounding an even more ancient tower in the middle of the woods. Luna learned that one of the scholars, a tall woman with considerable strength and whose methods sometimes raised eyebrows, had brought in a ward from the wood. The child was small and sick and hurt. Her parents were dead, or so the woman said, and why would she lie? The child suffered from a broken heart. She wept ceaselessly. She was a fountain of sorrow. The scholars decided that they would fill that child to bursting with magic, that they would infuse her skin, her bones, her blood, even her hair with magic. They wanted to see if they could. They wanted to know if it was possible. An adult could only use magic, but a child, the theory went, could become magic. But the process had never been tested and observed, not scientifically. No one had ever written down findings and drawn conclusions. All known evidence was anecdotal at best. The scholars were hungry for understanding, but some protested that it could kill the child. Others countered that if they hadn't found her in the first place, she would have died anyway, so what was the harm? But the girl didn't die. Instead, the girl's magic, infused into her very cells, continued to grow. It grew and grew and grew. They could feel it when they touched her. It thrummed under her skin. It filled the gaps in her tissues. It lived in the empty spaces in her atoms. It hummed in harmony with every tiny filament of matter. Her magic was particle, wave, and motion, probability and possibility. It bent and rippled and folded in on itself. It infused the whole of her. But one scholar, an elderly wizard by the name of Zosimos, was vehemently opposed to the enmagicment of the child and was even more opposed to the continuing work. He himself had been enmagicked as a young boy, and he knew the consequences of the action, the odd eruptions, the disruptions in thinking, the unpleasant extension of the lifespan. He heard the child sobbing at night, and he knew what some might do with that sorrow. He knew that not all who lived in the castle were good. And so he put a stop to it. He called himself the girl's guardian and bound their destinies together. This, too, had consequences. Zosimos warned the other scholars about the scheming of their colleague, the Sorrow Eater. Every day her power increased. Every day her influence widened. The warnings of old Zosimos fell on deaf ears. The old man wrote her name with a shiver of fear. Luna, standing in that room reading the story, surrounded by those papers, shivered too. And the girl grew, and her powers increased, and she was impulsive and sometimes self-centered, as children often are, and she didn't notice when the wizard who loved her, her beloved Zosimos, began slowly withering away, aging, weakening. No one noticed, until it was too late. "We only hope," the papers whispered in Luna's ear, "that when she meets the Sorrow Eater again, our girl is older, stronger, and more sure of herself. We only hope that, after our sacrifice, she will know what to do." "But who?" Luna asked them. "Who was the girl? Can I warn her?" "Oh," the papers said as they quivered in the air. "We thought we told you already. Her name is Zan." Chapter 28, in which several people go into the woods. Zan sat by the fireplace, twisting her apron this way and that until it was all in knots. There was something in the air, she could feel it, and something underground, a buzzing, rumbling, irritated something. She could feel that, too. Her back hurt, her hands hurt, her knees and her hips and her elbows and her ankles, and each bone in her swollen feet hurt and hurt and hurt. As each click, each pulse, each second pulled them closer to that point on the gears of Luna's life when every hand pointed toward 13, Zan could feel herself thinning, shrinking, fading. She was as light and as fragile as paper. "Paper," she thought. "My life is made of paper. Paper birds, paper maps, paper books, paper journals, paper words, and paper thoughts. Everything fades and shreds and crinkles away to nothing." She could remember Zosimos, dear Zosimos. How close did he seem to her now, leaning over his stacks of paper with 6 candles burning brightly around the perimeter of his desk, scratching his knowledge into the rough, clean space. "My life was written on paper and preserved on paper, all those bloody scholars scratching their notes and their thoughts and their observations. If I had died, they would have inscribed my demise on paper and never shed a tear. And here is Luna, the same as I was. And here am I, holding on to the one word that could explain everything, and the girl cannot read it or even hear it." It wasn't fair. What the men and women in the castle had done to Zan was not fair. What Zan had done to Luna was not fair. What the citizens of the Protectorate had done to their own babies was not fair. None of it was fair. Zan stood and looked out the window. Luna had not returned. Perhaps that was for the best. She would leave a note. Some things were easier said on paper anyway. Zan had never left so early to retrieve the protectorate baby, but she couldn't risk being late, not after last time. And she couldn't risk being seen, either. Transformations were difficult, and she had to contend with the possibility that she might not have the strength to undo this one. More consequences. Zan fastened her traveling cloak and slid her feet into a pair of sturdy boots and packed her satchel full of bottles of milk and soft, dry cloths and a bit of food for herself. She whispered a spell to keep the milk from spoiling and tried to ignore the degree to which the spell drained her energies and spirits. "Which bird?" she murmured to herself. "Which bird? Which bird?" She considered transforming herself into a raven and taking on a bit of its cunning, or an eagle and taking on a bit of its fight. An albatross, with its effortless flight, also seemed like a good idea, except a lack of water might impede her ability to take off and land. In the end, she chose the swallow. Small, yes, and delicate, but a good flyer and a keen eye. She would have to take breaks, and a swallow was small and brown and nearly invisible to predators. Zan closed her eyes and pressed her feet to the ground and felt the magic flow through her fragile bones. She felt herself become light and small and keen. Bright eyes, agile toes, a sharp, sharp mouth. She shook her wings, felt so deep within herself the need to fly she thought she might die of it, and with a high, sad cry of loneliness and missing Luna, she fluttered into the air and slid over the fringe of trees. She was as light as paper. Antane waited for their child to be born before he began his journey. The day of sacrifice was weeks away, but there would be no more births in the ensuing time. There were about 24 pregnant women in the Protectorate, but all of them had only just begun to show their bellies. Their labors were months away, not weeks. The birth, thankfully, was an easy one, or Athene claimed it was easy. But every time she cried out, Antane felt himself die inside. Birth was loud and messy and frightening, and it felt to Antane as if it took a lifetime or more, though in truth they were only at it for the better part of the morning. The baby came squalling into the world at lunchtime. "A proper gentleman, this one," the midwife said, "makes his appearance at the most reasonable of hours." They named him Lucan, and they marveled at his tiny toes and his delicate hands and the way his eyes fixed upon their faces. They kissed his small, searching, howling mouth. Antane never felt more sure of what he had to do. He left the next morning, well before the sun rose, with his wife and child still asleep in the bed. He couldn't bear to say goodbye. The madwoman stood at her window, her face resting on the bars. She watched the young man slide out of the quiet house. She had been waiting for him to appear for hours. She didn't know how she knew to wait for him, only that she did. The sun had not yet come up, and the stars were sharp and clear as broken glass spangled across the sky. She saw him slip out of his front door and close it silently behind him. She watched him as he laid his hand on the door, pressing his palm against the wood. For a moment, she thought he might change his mind and go back inside, back to the family that lay asleep in the dark. But he didn't. He closed his eyes tight, heaved a great sigh, and turned on his heel, hurrying down the dark lane toward the place on the town wall where the climb was least steep. The madwoman blew him a kiss for luck. She watched him pause and shiver as the kiss hit him. Then he continued on his way, his steps noticeably lighter. The madwoman smiled. There was a life she used to know. There was a world she used to live in, but she could hardly remember it. Her life before was as insubstantial as smoke. She lived, instead, in this world of paper. Paper birds, paper maps, paper people, dust and ink and pulped wood and time. The young man walked in the shadows, checking this way and that to see if anyone followed him. He had a satchel and a bedroll slung across his back, a cloak that would be too heavy during the day and not nearly warm enough at night, and swinging at his hip, a long, sharp knife. "You must not go alone," the madwoman whispered. "There are dangers in the wood, There are dangers here that will follow you into the wood. And there is one who is more dangerous than you could possibly imagine. When she was a little girl, she had heard stories about the witch. The witch lived in the woods, she was told, and had a tiger's heart. But the stories were wrong. And what truth they had was twisted and bent. The witch was here, in the tower. And while she didn't have a tiger's heart, she would rip you to shreds if given the chance. The madwoman stared at the window's iron bars until they were no longer iron bars at all, but paper bars. She tore them to shreds. And the stones surrounding the window's opening were no longer stones, just damp clumps of pulp. She scooped them out of the way with her hands. The paper birds around her murmured and fluttered and squawked. They opened their wings. Their eyes began to brighten and search. They lifted as one into the air, and they streamed through the window, carrying the madwoman on their collective backs, and flowed silently into the sky. The sisters discovered the madwoman's escape an hour after dawn. There were accusations and explanations and search parties and forensic explorations and teams of detectives. Heads rolled. The cleanup was a long, nasty job, but quiet, of course. The sisters couldn't afford to let news of the escape leak into the protectorate. The last thing they needed was to allow the populace to be getting ideas. Ideas, after all, are dangerous. Grand Elder Gerland ordered a meeting with Sister Ignatia just before lunch, despite her protestations that today simply was too difficult.
"I don't care two whits about your feminine complications," the Grand Elder roared as he marched into her study. The other sisters scurried away, shooting murderous glances at the Grand Elder, which thankfully he didn't notice. Sister Ignatia felt it best not to mention the escaped prisoner. Instead, she called for tea and cookies and offered hospitality to the fuming Grand Elder.
"Pray, dear Gerland," she said, "whatever is this about?"
She regarded him with hooded, predatory eyes.
"It has happened," Gerland said wearily.
Unconsciously, Sister Ignatia's eyes flicked in the direction of the now empty cell.
"It?"
she asked.
"My nephew. He left this morning. His wife and their baby are sheltering at my sister's house."
Sister Ignatia's mind began to race. They couldn't be connected, these two disappearances. They couldn't. She would have known. Wouldn't she? There had been, of course, a marked drop in available sorrow from the madwoman. Sister Ignatia hadn't given it much thought. While it was annoying to have to go hungry in one's own home, there was always sorrow aplenty throughout the protectorate, hanging over the town like a cloud. Or normally there was. But this blasted hope, stirred up by Antane, was spreading through the town, disrupting the sorrow. Sister Ignatia felt her stomach rumble. She smiled and rose to her feet. She gently laid her hand on the Grand Elder's arm, giving it a tender squeeze. Her long, sharp nails pierced his robes like a tiger's claws, making him cry out in pain. She smiled and kissed him on both cheeks.
"Fear not, my boy," she said. "Leave Antane to me. The forest is filled with dangers."
She pulled her hood over her head and strode to the door.
"I hear there's a witch in the wood. Did you know?"
And she disappeared into the hall.
"No," Luna said.
"No, no, 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 no."
She held the note from her grandmother in her hands for only a moment before she tore it to shreds. She didn't even read past the first sentence.
"No, no, 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 no."
"Caw," the crow said, though it sounded more like, "Don't do anything stupid." Anger buzzed through Luna's body from the top of her head to the bottoms of her feet. "This is how a tree must feel," she thought, "as it is hit by lightning." She glared at the torn-up note, wishing that it would reassemble itself so that she might tear it up again. She turned away before she could notice the pieces begin to quiver slightly, inching toward one another. Luna gave the crow a defiant look.
"I'm going after her."
"Caw," the crow said, though Luna knew he meant
That is a very stupid idea. You don't even know where you're going.
I do, too, Luna said, sticking out her chin and pulling her journal from her satchel. See?
Caw, the crow said. You made that up, he meant. I once had a dream that I could breathe underwater like a fish. You don't see me trying that now, do you?
She's not strong enough, Luna said, feeling her voice start to crack. What if her grandmother became injured in the woods, or sick, or lost? What if Luna never saw her again? I need to help her. I need her. The bits of paper with the deer and the Luna fluttered their edges together, fusing neatly side by side until no evidence of their separation remained. So too did the shred bearing, "By the time you read this," and "There are things I must explain," underneath. And underneath that was, "You are ever so much more than you realize." Luna slid her feet into her boots and packed a rucksack with whatever she could think of that might be useful on a journey. Hard cheese, dried berries, a blanket, a water flask, a compass with a mirror, her grandmother's star map, a very sharp knife.
"Caw?" the crow said, though it sounded more like, "Aren't you going to tell Glurk and Furion?"
"Of course not. They just try to stop me." Luna sighed. A small, torn scrap of paper scurried its way across the room, as nimble as any mouse. Luna didn't notice. She didn't notice it creeping up her leg and along the back of her cloak. She didn't notice it burrow its way into her pocket.
"No," she said finally. "They'll figure out where I'm going. And anything I say will come out wrong. Everything I say comes out wrong."
"Aw," the crow said. "I don't think that's true." But it didn't matter what the crow thought. Luna's mind was made up. She tied on her hood and checked the map that she had made. It looked detailed enough. And of course the crow was right. And of course Luna knew how dangerous the woods were. But she knew the way. She was sure of it.
"Are you coming with me or what?"
she said to the crow as she left her home and slid into the green.
"Caw,"
the crow said.
"To the ends of the earth, my Luna, to the ends of the earth."
"Well,"
Glurk said, looking at the mess in the house,
"this is not good at all."
"Where is Auntie Zan?" Furion wailed.
He buried his face in a hanky, by turns lighting it on fire and then dousing the flames with his tears.
"Why wouldn't she say goodbye?"
"Zan can take care of herself," Glurk said. "It's Luna who worries me."
He said this because it seemed like it must be true, but it wasn't. His worry for Zan had him tied up in knots.
"What was she thinking?" Glurk moaned in his thoughts. "And how can I bring her back safe?"
Glurk sat heavily on the floor. His great tail curled around his body, reading over the note that Zan had left for Luna. "Dear Luna," it said, "by the time you read this, I will be traveling quickly across the forest."
"Quickly? Ah," he murmured. "She has transformed."
He shook his head. Glurk knew better than anyone how Zan's magic had drained away. What would happen if she became stuck in her transformation? If she was permanently ensquirreled or enbirded or endeared? Or even more troubling, if she could only manage a halfway transformation?
"Things are changing in you, dearest, inside and out. I know you can sense it, but you have no words for it. This is my fault. You have no idea who you are, and that is my fault, too. There are things that I kept from you because of circumstance, and things that I kept from you because I didn't want to break your heart. But it doesn't change the facts. You are ever so much more than you realize."
"What does it say, Glurk?"
Furion said, buzzing from one side of Glurk's head to the other like a persistent and annoying bumblebee.
"Give us a moment, will you, my friend?"
Glurk murmured. Hearing Glurk use the word friend in relation to himself made Furion positively giddy with happiness. He trilled his tongue against the roof of his mouth and turned a backflip and a double spin in the air, accidentally knocking his head against the ceiling.
Of course I'll give you a moment, Glurk, my friend, Firion said, shrugging off the bump on his skull. I'll give you all the moments in the world.
He fluttered down to the armrest of the rocking chair and made himself as prim and still as he possibly could. Glurk looked closer at the paper, not at the words but at the paper itself. It had been torn, he could see, and had been knit back together so tightly most eyes would not have caught the change. Zan would have seen it. Glurk looked even closer at the threads of the magic, each individual strand. Blue. A shimmer of silver at the edges. There were millions of them. And none of them originated from Zan.
Luna, he whispered. Oh, Luna.
It was starting early. Her magic. All that power. The great surging ocean of it. Was leaking out. He had no way of knowing whether the child meant to do it or even noticed it happening at all. He remembered when Zan was young, how she would make ripe fruit explode in a shower of stars just by standing too closely. She was dangerous then, to herself and to others, as Luna was when she was young, as she likely was now.
When you were a baby, I rescued you from a terrible fate. And then I accidentally offered you the moon to drink. And you did drink it, which exposed you to yet another terrible fate. I am sorry. You will live long, and you will forget much, and the people you love will die, and you will keep going. This was my fate, and now it is yours. There is only one reason for it.
Glurk knew the reason, of course, but it was not in the letter. Instead, there was a perfectly torn hole where the word magic had been. He looked around the floor, but he didn't see it anywhere. This was one of the things he couldn't stand about magic, generally. Magic was a troublesome thing, foolish, and it had a mind of its own.
It is the word that could not stick in your mind, but it is the word that defines your life, as it has defined mine. I only hope I will have enough time to explain everything before I leave you again, for the last time. I love you more than I could possibly say. Your loving grandmother.
Glurk folded up the letter and slid it under the candlestick. He looked around the room with a sigh. It was true that Zan's days were dwindling, and it was true that, in comparison to his excessively long life, Zan's was no more than a deep breath, or a swallow, or the blink of an eye, and soon she would be gone forever. He felt his heart ball up in his throat in a hard, sharp lump.
Glurk?
Firion ventured. He buzzed toward the ancient swamp monster's face, peering into those large, damp eyes. Glurk blinked and stared back. The dragonling, he had to admit, was a sweet little thing. Big-hearted. Young. But unnaturally so. And now was the time for him to grow up. Past time, really. Glurk pulled himself to his feet and his first set of arms, bending back a bit to ease out the kinks in his spine. He loved his small swamp, of course he did, and he loved his small life here in the crater of the volcano. He had chosen it without regrets. But he loved the wide world, too. There were parts of himself that he had left behind to live with Zan. Glurk could barely remember them. But he knew they were bountiful and life-giving and vast. The bog. The world. All living things. He had forgotten how much he loved it all. His heart leaped within him as he took his first step.
Come, Firion, he said, holding his top left hand out and allowing the dragon to alight on his palm. We are going on a journey.
A real journey? Firion said. You mean away from here?
That is the only kind of journey, young fellow, and yes, away from here. That sort of journey.
But,
Firion began. He fluttered away from the hand and buzzed to the other side of the swamp monster's great head.
What if we get lost?
I never get lost,
Glurk said, and it was true. Once upon a time, many ages ago, He traveled around the world more times than he could count. And in the world, and above and below. A poem, a bog, a deep longing. He could barely remember it now, of course. One of the hazards of so very long a life.
But,
Therion began, zooming from one side of Glurk's face to the other and back again.
What if I should frighten people with my remarkable size? What if they flee in terror?
Glurk rolled his eyes.
While it is true, my young friend, that your size is, remarkable, I believe that a simple explanation from me will ease their fears. As you know, I have excellent skills at explaining things.
Therion landed on Glurk's back.
This is true,
he murmured.
No one explains things better than you, Glurk.
And then he threw his small body against the swamp monster's great, damp back and flung his arms wide in an attempt at a hug.
There's no need for that,
Glurk said, and Therion drifted back up into the air, hovering over his friend.
Look, Glurk continued, do you see? Luna's footprints.
And so they followed her, the ancient swamp monster and the perfectly tiny dragon, into the wood. And with each footprint, Glurk became increasingly aware that the magic leaking from the young girl's feet was growing. It seeped, then shined, then pooled on the ground, then spilled from the edges. At this rate, how long would it take for that magic to flow like water, move like streams and rivers and oceans? How long before it flooded the world? How long indeed? Chapter 29, in which there is a story with a volcano in it. It is not an ordinary volcano, you know. It was made thousands and thousands of years ago by a witch.
Which witch?
Oh, I don't know. Not the witch we've got, surely. She is old, but she's not that old. Of course I don't know how old she is. No one does, and no one has seen her. I hear she looks like a young girl sometimes, and an old woman sometimes, and a grown lady other times. It all depends. The volcano has dragons in it. Or it did. Time was that there were dragons all over creation, but now no one has seen them in an age. Maybe longer.
How should I know what happened to them? Maybe the witch got them. Maybe she ate them. She is always hungry, you know. The witch is, I mean.
Let that keep you in your bed at night. Every time the volcano erupts, it is larger, angrier, more ferocious. Time was, it was no bigger than an ant's hill. Then it was the size of a house. Now it's bigger than the forest, and one day, it will envelop the whole world, you see if it won't. The last time the volcano erupted, it was the witch that caused it. You don't believe me? Oh, it's as true as you're standing here. In those days, the forest was safe. There were no pitfalls or poisonous vents. Nothing burned. And there were villages dotting this way and that through the forest. Villages that collected mushrooms. Villages that traded in honey. Villages that made beautiful sculptures out of clay and hardened them with fire. And they were all connected by trails and small roads that crossed and crisscrossed the forest like a spider's web. But the witch, she hates happiness. She hates it all. So she brought her army of dragons into the belly of the mountain. Heave! She shouted at the dragons, and they heaved fire into the heart of the volcano. Heave! She shouted again. And the dragons were afraid. Dragons, if you must know, are wicked creatures, full of violence and duplicity and deceit. Still, the deceit of a dragon was nothing in the face of the wickedness of the witch.
Please, the dragons cried, shivering in the heat. Please stop this. You'll destroy the world.
What care have I for the world? The witch laughed. The world never cared for me at all. If I want it to burn, well then it will burn. And the dragons had no choice. They heaved and heaved until they were nothing more than ash and embers and smoke. They heaved until the volcano burst into the sky, raining destruction across every forest every farm, every meadow. Even the bog was undone. When the volcano's eruption would have destroyed everything, if it hadn't been for the brave little wizard. He walked into the volcano and, well, I'm not entirely clear what he did, but he stopped it right up and saved the world. He died doing it, poor thing. Pity he didn't kill the witch, but nobody's perfect. Despite everything, we must thank him for what he's done. But the volcano never really went out. The wizard stopped it up, but it went underground, and it leaks its fury into the water pools and the mud bats and the noxious vents. It poisons the bog. It contaminates the water. It is the reason why our children go hungry, and our grandmothers wither, and our crops are so often doomed to fail. It is the reason we cannot ever leave this place, and there is no use trying. But no matter. One day it will erupt again. And then we will be out of our misery. Chapter 30. In which things are more difficult than originally planned. Luna hadn't been walking for long before she was very, very lost and very, very frightened. She had her map, and she could see in her mind's eye the route that she should travel, but she had already lost her way. The shadows looked like wolves. The trees clacked and creaked in the wind, their branches curled like sharp claws scratching at the sky. Bats screeched and owls hooted their replies. The rocks creaked under her feet, and beneath that, she could feel the mountain churning, churning, churning. The ground was hot, then cold, then hot again. Luna lost her footing in the dark and tumbled head over feet into a muddy ravine. She cut her hand. She twisted her ankle. She knocked her skull against a low-hanging branch and burned her leg in a boiling spring. She was fairly certain she had blood in her hair.
"Caw," said the crow. "I told you this was a terrible idea."
"Quiet," Luna muttered. "You're worse than Furion."
"Caw,"
said the crow, but what he meant was any number of unrepeatable things.
"Language,"
Luna admonished. "And anyway, I don't believe I like your tone." Meanwhile, something continued happening inside Luna that she could not explain. The clicking of gears that she had felt almost her whole life was now more like the gonging of a bell. The word magic existed. She knew that now, but what it was and what it meant were still a mystery. Something itched in her pocket. A small, papery something crinkled and rattled and squirmed. Luna did her best to ignore it. She had bigger problems at hand. The forest was thick with trees and undergrowth. The shadows crowded out the light. With each step, she paused and gingerly patted her foot in front of her, feeling around for solid ground. She had been walking all night, and the moon, nearly full, had vanished in the trees, taking the light with it. "What have you gotten yourself into?" the shadows seemed to say, tutting and harumphing. There wasn't even enough light to see the map that she had drawn, not that a map would do her any good so far off her intended trail. "Stuff and bother," Luna muttered, carefully taking another step. The path was tricky here. Hairpin curves and needle-like rock formations. Luna could feel the vibration of the volcano under her feet. It didn't relent, not even for a moment.
"Sleep," she thought at it. "You're supposed to be sleeping."
The volcano didn't seem to know this.
"Aw," said the crow. "Forget the volcano. You should sleep," he meant.
This was true. Lost as she was, Luna was hardly making any progress. She should stop, rest, and wait until morning. But her grandmother was out here. And what if she was hurt? And what if she was sick? And what if she didn't come back? Luna knew that everything alive must die someday. She had seen it with her own eyes when she assisted her grandmother. People died. And while it made their loved ones sad, it didn't seem to bother the dead person one bit. They were dead, after all. They had moved on to other matters. She once asked Glurk what happens to people when they died. He had closed his eyes and said,
"The bog."
There was a dreamy smile on his face.
The bog. The bog. The bog.
It was the most unpoetic thing he had ever said. Luna was impressed, but it didn't exactly answer her question. Luna's grandmother had never spoken about